As we just reported, a growing number of people are trying to track down the precious metal gold. There's even a TV show called Gold Fever. And the fight over mining for gold up in California's gold country could be a symptom of a much larger problem. Unemployment. It's still high in the U.S. About 8.5% of Americans are unemployed, which is why the prospect of mining for gold to earn a living might not seem like such a bad idea. But even those of us who still have jobs in this depressed economy face a host of problems. What happens if you don't like your job? What if you're interested in a career change? Chances are you're not going to just quit because it doesn't interest you anymore. The idea of going out into an incredibly weak job market is enough to make the most courageous person think twice before leaving his job.
I sit in a cubicle and I update bank software for the 2000 switch, and it doesn't really matter. I don't like my job, and I don't think I'm gonna go anymore.
So you're gonna quit?
Nuh-uh, not really. I'm just gonna stop going.
Many of us have experienced burnout when we get bored with our work or sick of our colleagues, for example. But what happens when your work is all about other people? If you're a doctor or a nurse or a teacher? Researcher Eve Ekman says you're more likely to experience empathy burnout if you're in one of these caring professions. I sat down with PhD student Eve Ekman to find out about her research on empathy burnout. I asked her to start by telling us what she sees happening.
Luckily, this picture is not totally grim. As a social worker in the ER the last 6 years, there's a high volume of suffering. The intensity is quite high, and you know, people are coming in every day with things such as traumatic accidents or chronic illnesses. And when I watch staff interact with these clients, I started to take note that many people, despite this high volume, were able to still be human and present and engaged.
And compassionate.
Compassionate. And most people would believe that being exposed to that level of trauma on an everyday basis would kind of shut you down. And often actually what's taught in medical school is to kind of shut down, to withhold emotions in order to be able to perform your job. However, emotions are such a critical part of our job, in especially quick momentary assessments, as we need to do in the ER, as well as these big transitions when you have a sudden mortality or a sudden loss of medical ability due to an accident in the ER. So my interest was, how do I understand, you know, the portion of the staff that are able to empathically engage, seemingly endlessly, to those who seem to have absolutely no empathy available whatsoever?
Just because they're too overwhelmed and stressed out by the caseload?
This is what I was wondering. I was lucky enough to start at the same time as about a dozen nurses who are all around my age, so in their early 30s now. And when we started, we were all about 25 or so. And they were coming from varied backgrounds, but had gone through the same nursing program. They were all hired at the same time during this kind of up hire at that time. So it was a little bit of a perfect sample, a naturalistic sample, we call in the sciences. And I saw that some of them, every single day, despite the kind of patients spinning and yelling and, you know, some of our more difficult patients, were still able to be totally human, maintain their integrity, and treat these people with respect, whereas others seem to have no patience whatsoever.
So what do you think was the key difference?
So I think, you know, of course, there's some differences in the way that people are brought up and they're raised and their education, their training. But essentially what it comes down to is a model of stress. There's some stress that makes us feel threatened and some stress that makes us feel challenged. So our response to stress that is threatening is we kind of, you know, pull everything in, shut down, and don't really engage. When we are challenged, we raise up to that. Our entire autonomic nervous system, our heart rate, everything is engaged so that we can meet this challenge. So what I really thought of is some of these nurses feel incredibly challenged and some of them feel incredibly threatened. And luckily, there's a great deal of research from this field of stress that helps us understand where this comes from. It's actually your perception of what's going on at that moment. If you feel you have the resources available to meet the demands, you know, it's not that some people have more education or more physical strength or more mental strength. There's a lot of equivalency across these. So it's your perception, the way you deal with this stress.
So give us one example, a concrete example of somebody dealing with this and maybe not feeling empathy.
So I think, you know, in the ER, what you often see is, you know, you have these chronic patients who come in who seem hopeless. So they are inebriates, you know, they are, you have this, let's
say.
So
you're drunks who are coming in
every day,
every month.
And they are, you know, they're barely making it to the parking lot before they fall down and they come back in. You feel like you're not getting any work done. They're often rude, they're mean, they don't smell good.
And they're taking up space where a little kid who has pneumonia might not get into the ER.
Exactly. And they're often berating to the staff, and so you get this very difficult situation, and you have staff who are quickly dismissive of these patients. What we can actually know from research is these patients are really sick, and so by kind of ignoring that this person, despite their kind of difficultness, actually has medical issues, you are increasing the likelihood they'll come right back. They'll get more sick. They have, you know, chronic heart disease. They have pulmonary issues. They have diabetes. And to kind of bring them in and just do a tertiary exam and let them go because of your inability to really see their suffering.
That's researcher Eve Ekman. She's with UC Berkeley. And we're talking about this idea of clinical empathy and caregiver burnout. And you give another example of a young man who came in with a bullet wound.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, we have such a high volume of gang violence in the ER, and it's very deeply upsetting for people who work there. You see young men dying all the time, and the families who are affected, it's such a small community, unfortunately, that when these situations occur, the entire community shows up. Our staff has a negative reaction because this means there's a lot of emotional people in the ER and they have a young man who might be dying. So the first reaction is, let's shut it down, let's keep it safe. And that often means that let's keep family members away from their dying loved ones. So how do you convince staff that it's really important that the family needs to be there in case this is the last time they see their son? Yes, they may be crying. Yes, they may be falling on the floor, but it's our responsibility to recognize that this mother is losing her son.
We've been mostly talking about healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
What about things like the education system?
Mm-hmm.
Teachers are so overstressed and,
sure.
and very underpaid in
yeah.
a lot of cases. What's the relevance here for teachers and people working in juvenile halls,
right.
et cetera?
Absolutely. Well, my field research is in juvenile hall, and it's a little bit of a stretch for some people to consider guards in a juvenile hall to be care providers. I couldn't disagree more. I think they have a lot of the same desires that school teachers have to make a difference in the lives of youth. And my preliminary research there and the focus groups I've been doing, I've been proved right. All of them got into this work because they wanted to make a difference. And the great deal of stress and frustration is when they don't feel they can. And it would seem common sense, but, you know, I was very shocked to hear that there's actually there's no trainings that exist currently for staff burnout in the criminal justice system, the juvenile justice system. And, you know, with school teachers, I think you have much of the same concern where majority of what brings people to the work is their desire to do well, their desire to make a difference and do good. Often that is, unfortunately, becomes an albatross around your neck, becomes a thing that can pull you down. And burnout research has actually identified a separate scale for school teachers that really emphasizes how important it is to get that feedback.
From students, from colleagues, from whom?
That's a great point. It's from students and from colleagues. Sometimes we need that support from our coworkers. People are often surprised when I tell them that my study on empathy isn't just about the care provider to their client. It's about the care provider with their coworker and with their client. Empathy requires that people are aware of what's happening with them in terms of how they relate to others. Others is not distinguished between simply their clients. And that's why this research is relevant, actually, to lawyers, of course, to folks in the corporate world, and kind of across the board. My intent is to start with those I feel are in the deepest need, but I definitely see how these ideas could be used in many settings.
That's UC Berkeley researcher Eve Ekman, and we're talking about clinical empathy for caregivers and particularly burnout in the workplace for people who are on the front lines, particularly nurses, teachers, et cetera. And you have something of a prescription. Your research has led you to believe that there are things that you can do to increase empathy,
mm-hmm.
or clinical empathy, as you call it.
The reality is burnout, it's not an endpoint. And it's not just some people. There are, I think, cycles of burnout. People will feel burnout and then they won't and then they will again. So how do you address burnout as a long-term job issue? I think there's a couple simple steps, which is really orienting yourself to your own physiology. So that means feeling your toes, feeling your knees, feeling your hips, feeling your elbows, feeling your shoulders. By the time you get to your head, you're calmer.
Okay, so number one, check in with yourself physically.
Mm-hmm. And another, I would say, is definitely to, by whatever means necessary, increase support you can get from your coworkers. So if that means that everyone brings lunch for someone once a week, or everyone has this time in which they check in, you don't want to create more time in the workday. You know, folks are eager to leave. You don't say, yeah, let's all stay after for an hour. No, that's not realistic. However, creating these very small ways in which folks in some ways support and or celebrate one another, this is hugely important. And the third, of course, and this is by many folks the most important, I think just one addition, is what it is that you do outside of your job that gives you meaning, that gives you a break. And to make sure that you spend as much time investing in that as you do in the workplace. So I'm not saying hour to hour, but if you are going to work every day, you need to create a container for what you bring home. Now, one of the things I'm working on is a tool that will help folks check in through text message. Create a
report. Or just a little chime.
A little chime, yeah. And I think, you know, you can also do data collection through this so that what you create in the end is a little report. So after the end of a week, someone sees, this is what I did, this is when I was stressed, this is how I felt. Interesting. So you, again, give people more opportunity to know what it is they're doing and feeling and not become robotic in their everyday work life.